Hello and welcome back to the Indie Film Toolkit Podcast. This is episode 12.
Woot, 1 year.
I am your host, Wade Wojcik, joined by David Ishida.
Hello.
And Ben Robertson.
Hey.
Late.
Nope, he's alive this time. He's back from the dead. And we got a great episode this month. We're talking about, first of all, in Tools of the Trade, camera stabilizers. And I'm really excited to talk about that because that has undergone many changes over the last decade or so. Mm-hmm. And David, you put together a good, you know, a good roster here to talk about tricks of the trade, set etiquette when you are on a film set, what to do and what not to do depending on your department. We're going to go into that. That's going to be a lot of fun. Finally, this episode, we finally saw an actual indie film, Voice from the Stone, which was made by Eric Howell, a local indie filmmaker from the Twin Cities, and we all definitely saw it. All right, Ben saw it. Good. Yeah. And great. So starting off, camera stabilizers. David, I noticed that we're looking at the glide cam, which I remember back in high school,
mm-hmm.
seen in like a magazine ad.
Yep.
And it was super expensive. Mm-hmm. If you get it with the vest,
right.
It comes in different pieces. There's the rod thing that you hold.
Yeah, like then the post.
And like an arm, a mm-hmm. spring loaded arm, and then the vest that it attaches yep. to. And that all together, I think, was like $2,000 or something like that.
Yep. And so, and that also is very similar to what would have been the styles of the Steadicam, which is, I think, one of the oldest brands for that.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at camera stabilizers, if you're doing any kind of camera stabilization, and so when we say stabilization, it's basically stabilizing a handheld shot, making it look very smooth and buttery, but without putting it on like a dolly, so yeah. still retaining a certain handheld movement. You know, 25 years ago, 30 years ago, that was only really accomplished through a Steadicam. That's what it had to be. And Steadicam operators are very, very talented people.
Because you have to, there's a skill involved. You can't just pick it up and anyone can do it.
Absolutely.
You got to know exactly what you're
absolutely.
Doing.
Absolutely. In my time so far, I've probably used a Steadicam for a total of probably about 20 hours or so.
Wow.
And I'm still not great with it.
Okay.
Or anything like it takes a lot of time. And so what's happened over the course of the past 15 years or so is there's been all these new styles of stabilization around. And the reason I wanted to look at the glide cam, and I'm looking specifically at the one that's just the post and a handle.
Yeah.
This one, if you watch any of Devin Supertramp, almost 90% of his shots are done off of a glide cam.
Really?
In fact, he has a signature one.
Yes,
too.
Yep. There's a more expensive one that is the Devin Graham signature edition.
I didn't realize people still use these.
Oh, yeah. They're very popular, mainly because they're cheap.
Okay. They are now.
Yes.
I don't know if they were back in the day.
Yeah. But you were looking at one with the full vest, where these ones are just that post and handle.
I was looking at one of these back in high school. What's funny is on their site, glidecam.com, they have their three models. Of course, the smallest one's discontinued, but the cameras on them are older cameras.
They are older.
And that's an indication mm-hmm. of where these are.
Yep, and these ones, I think it's the HD 2000 and the HD 4000. And I think it's a 2 to 6 pound on the 2000 and I think a 10 pound max on the 4000 or so.
Yeah.
And with those, what's convenient for an indie filmmaker is, one, they're cheap. Mm-hmm. I think the cheaper one of those is about $600 or so. And if you take the time to learn it really well, as I said, go look at Devin Graham's photography. And if there's anything that's not a drone shot, it's probably on one of these.
Yeah.
So you get good at it, it looks really good. It is definitely a big wear on your body because you're having to hold this up. And, much like a full Steadicam, it's not something that you pick up immediately. Like, you need to balance it just perfectly so it stays level all mm-hmm. the time. You need to like really have a light touch when doing pan or tilts with it,
right?
To make sure it stays steady and doesn't wobble yeah. and look a little wonky.
Well, in something like this, it's not very easy to, let's say, hold and then dolly, like walk to the side, right? If you strafe while grabbing one of these, it's probably not, like, there's going to be a little wobble in there.
It depends. If you have it balanced right and you know what you're doing, you can get really stable shots. But it definitely takes a lot of skill to do it.
Yeah.
But what makes it very appealing is that low price point, of getting that in for something that's doing what I would call, what I personally classify as passive stabilization, where it is, the stabilizing device is not actively doing anything.
Yeah.
It's sort of letting physics and gravity
yeah.
do the work for you.
Because the weights are beneath the camera and beneath your
right.
arm, it's trying to compensate for the pendulum motion that it would otherwise
exactly.
have.
Exactly. Exactly. And with this one, and there are like, and Glidecam is the gold standard of this style of what has become known as the Glidecam. But there are many other systems. Another company called VeriZoom makes one very similar to that. And I think it's a lot cheaper, but this one is sort of the gold standard of this style.
The gold standard of a dying type of stabilizer.
Well, we'll see, breed. Because it, you know, it was popular enough. You know, they have their booth every year at NAB. They're still showing off this stuff all the time.
Okay.
Though the, you know, it's funny because, as you mentioned, on their website, the cameras they show on here are very old cameras. They're probably about 15 years old or 10 years old.
Well, the products are old too. Have they released any new things in the last few years?
Yeah, a lot of it, as Ben mentioned, there is a Devin Graham Signature Edition came out last year. So
okay, version. But it doesn't offer any new functionality, right? It's still the same thing.
Yeah, I think that there's changes he did to it, like he suggested for it. But with these, what makes them, you know, it's like if you look at Steadicam. If you buy a brand new Steadicam right now, go to their website, buy a Steadicam. You'll get a DVD with it, a training DVD. That training DVD was made in 1978 or something. Okay. It's very old. I mean, maybe it was early 80s. It's very old because when it comes down to it, the principles of how you operate a Steadicam have not changed.
Yeah.
There's an arm with springs in it. You adjust those springs. The way you balance the camera on the post is exactly the same. Things have just gotten a little nicer since then. And I think that's much with here. You know, they have those old cameras because, you know, it doesn't really matter what camera you put on the end of it because how you balance it, the principle of operation is the same no matter what.
So sorry, go ahead, Ben.
So I have a question since we're eventually going to start talking about also the Ronin as well. But these stabilizers function differently, right? You're not going to get... Is there an application that you would choose? I'm going to use a Steadicam over, say, like a Ronin or anything like that?
Oh, yes, yes, absolutely, absolutely. That's one major folly when people, and I think is a mistake, because so many people, you know, there are Steadicam operators around here in the Twin Cities that once the Ronin came out, he stopped getting jobs because people are like, oh, I'll just get a Ronin. But a Ronin doesn't do the same thing. When you have a Steadicam, it's dealing with four axes of stabilization. It's dealing with the forward and backward, left and right, roll, and up and down from the walk. That arm is taking away the step of the walk. That's why they look so amazingly buttery smooth.
Yeah.
A Ronin doesn't have that. That up and down, it has to be dealt with by your body. Mm. Your body has to compensate. Your arms or how you walk has to compensate that movement. So depending on how you're doing the shot, and if you're doing it well, they do become very similar. But you know, if you look and compare it to someone having to run and hold a Ronin up with two hands, versus someone who's running with a Steadicam, the Steadicam looks a lot better, I think.
Mm-hmm. You know, prior to like the Movi and the Ronin being released, I do remember seeing like this style of Steadicam on all behind the scenes for films where there was like a lot of handheld camera movements. What's interesting though is still on their marketing page, I'm seeing photos I saw when I was in high school featuring a camera I bought in high school, and I don't know. Are they still just trying to stay to that business model until the end, or are they trying to innovate in any way?
I think it's one of those challenging things because looking at the film industry, the innovation, you do see a lot of, well, it still works.
Yeah.
And people are liking it the way it is. And it's one of those things of you can keep refining, but I think with how their design is, you know, there's a handle on a gimbal aspect that has the post running through it, camera above, weights down below. That really is the basics of, you can't get any more simple than that.
Sure.
So I think that in a certain point, there's not really much to innovate for.
Okay.
In that sense. But as I said, there's another online resource called Full Time Filmmaker. And it's made by, I don't remember the guy's name who started this, but he was a guy who got in with Devin Graham and was a shooter with Devin Graham for many years. And he started this this thing where it's basically, you know, it's like an online film school. You know, you pay $600, I think, and then you get, you know, all these courses that he's on, like, I think it's like 60 odd hours of stuff. And you can tell, because I watched his intro, a webinar on it. And you can very much tell that, like, the kind of filmmaking he's teaching is not cinematic filmmaking, if you will, as we were taught in school. It's Devin Graham-style filmmaking.
Sure.
And that's perfectly fine. There's nothing wrong with that. And one of the things in his kit is a glide cam.
Interesting.
That's what he shoots on. And I think it is because it's simple and it's light and it's small.
Yeah.
Is another thing. It's like, you know, I think some of them, you can either detach the weights out or they fold up. you know, compare that to how big of a case, if you guys remember when I had to take the Ronin out for Dawn Under Heaven, mm-hmm. that was a big case. Yeah. That was basically as wide as this table. It's basically about a 2.5-3 foot wide long case.
Yeah.
So it's not something that travels easily if you need to go flying.
And I will say on the pros of the GlideCam, it's a modular system. So you don't have to have the vest and the arm.
Right.
And the you can just grab and go with the glide cam if you want.
Yep, exactly.
Whereas with the Ronin, you got to have the whole system.
Right, yeah, and that's why I picked this one to talk about, because it is so easily accessible from a financial standpoint. Mm-hmm. And because, like, you can start out with that, and it's like, okay, I got more money, I'm getting more work, I want to buy the vest and the arm. You can buy that later.
Right.
Well, and the other nice thing is that you don't have to deal with batteries like you do with the Ronin.
Exactly.
Like with the Ronin, you have to deal with the batteries.
Gravity won't lose batteries.
Well, and oftentimes when we've been on set working with the Ronin, and even on this last project we were part of, David, I kept seeing the Ronin stabilization just fail and the camera just falls over. And you guys have to take time to reset it and recalibrate, which also takes, like, you know, 5 or 10 minutes on its own, which takes away time from your schedule and from your shooting time, throws stuff off, which, mm-hmm. I mean, I'm sure you have some of that to deal with a Steadicam, but as long as nobody touches it, like, you don't have to really worry about it too much, right?
Yeah. But remember, Steadicam is not the same as the Glidecam.
Sorry.
Remember, because
whichever way.
Yeah, that's another thing.
Steadicam's a brand, right?
Steadicam is a brand, and also it's that Kleenex that refers to the arm, the vest, and the post. That mm-hmm. whole system is usually called a Steadicam. Because also remember, for a Steadicam, you know, other than, like, this GlideCam is that, like, it doesn't have any power needs. But when you get to a Steadicam, usually because of how the balancing is done is a little different, mm-hmm. because it has the arm and whatnot that's doing some other work, there's usually a monitor on it. And then it has batteries for the monitor and also usually powers the camera through those same batteries as well.
Oh, and because it adds extra weight, you still have to do a little bit of calibration?
Yeah, it adds sort of another wrinkle of things of balancing.
Gotcha. So I'm going to eat my words here a little. I go into their products page on GlideCam.com. They do have a 3-axis gimbal.
Yes, they do. Yep.
It's called the GlideCam Centurion, and it's designed for DSLR type cameras.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I believe that came out this year, I believe.
Yeah, so that goes for, right now it's on sale for $1,000.
Very inexpensive.
Yeah, and let's see, so if you get their full, like, vest and arm, I think that it says it goes for $1,500, and so about $2,000 still.
Mm-hmm.
Which I guess counting for inflation isn't bad, considering it was that, you know, 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. They also offer sliders, which is cool. You know, the sliders mm-hmm. you use with the DSLR.
And I believe they do some jibs as well.
Yeah, they do. But there's this one product called the GlideCam Stunt Bar, and I'll just zoom in here to the thumbnail. Looking at this. All right, wait, remember to edit this. but look at that. It's a metal rod with a handle that a guy on a skateboard's holding.
With
a Canon XL pointed directly at his pants. Like, it's not even set up to look like that. Wouldn't even look good.
No, it wouldn't.
I think it was a PVC pipe. Yeah,
but looking at that photo, if most people tried to do that, they would just fall and break the camera.
Yeah.
Not a very safe setup.
And as you mentioned there, they have a digital stabilizer. The other one I wanted to talk about was the Ronin M. The first company to sort of mass produce a handheld gimbal stabilizer, as we would call nowadays, is Movi. Mm-hmm. But they weren't the people to invent that system. That system has existed for helicopters and airplanes for 20 years, that kind of thing. They were just the first ones to want to miniaturize that system down to put a camera on.
Yeah, I remember seeing a GIF online of someone using the Movi and, like, jumping up and down or something, and the camera mm-hmm. staying perfectly
stable.
Yeah,
or waving their arms
around.
Windmilling their arms practically.
And then I saw their demo video of someone on, I think it was rollerblades, shooting mm-hmm. in the window of a taxi. Well, two mm-hmm. people in the cab were having a conversation, and then the person let go of the window and just kind of trailed back, and it looked beautiful. And And I really got that was my first impression of, wow, on a low budget, you can get these awesome-looking shots.
It's true, except when you look at that particular video, that first Ronin was $15,000.
The Movi?
The Movi, it was $15,000. And that's one many people have cited is the big mistake that Movi had, is when they announced that at NAB 5 years ago, 6 years ago, whenever it was, their biggest mistake was not having product there to hand people. because they got delayed, and that gave a lot of other people opportunity to start developing stuff. So they were still first to market, but then we had people like DJI come out with the Ronin.
Yeah, the Ronin came out super quick after that.
Mm-hmm. And that system was a fraction of the price. That thing has a 15-pound payload, and it started at, I think, $3,000 originally.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So a fraction of the
price. Wasn't there also the Lettuce? I didn't hear much about that, though.
Yeah, that came out years later, and that's... Don't look at that system. That's ridiculous. And so when we're getting into this digital, this is one that I personally classified as active stabilization. There's active things that are happening to, like, the system is actively working to stabilize. And so the way these systems work, very simply, there's an accelerometer in the bottom of it, just like in your phone. And then that feeds information to a bunch of brushless motors. The reason that brushless is important is it means they're smooth movement. They don't need to stutter and click along. And then it works to keep it level, basically as fast as the speed of light, or as fast as electricity moves through a wire,
right,
to relay that information to the motors. And the low price point and the ease of use of this has really opened up these things, especially as the price has gotten cheaper.
Yeah, it's $1,000 right now in their store. But mm-hmm. They're also coming out with another one too, soon, right?
Yep. And though that one, that's the Ronin 2. And I don't think that a price has been announced on that yet, though it's a big, beefy system. It's about 12 and a half pounds, empty. So that's with batteries, but no camera. But the max camera payload is 30 pounds.
Okay, so
you can do a pretty ridiculous system, assuming it balances correctly.
So you would still, that's not their catch-all solution. You'd still want the Ronin 1 for later cameras then, right?
Well, no, I think the idea is that you would use that, but I think this one is really geared towards people who would only be using the big cameras, like larger film productions. We're shooting this on a pretty well-loaded out Red Epic or an Alexa Mini or, some of the bigger cameras or especially bigger lenses.
Okay.
And heavier lenses. So, but for the indie filmmaker, that Ronin, the Ronin M, it's the one that's designed for DSLRs.
Yeah.
It's the max payload is, I think, 6 pounds or 5 pounds. So it really is for a DSLR and a simple, small lens. Like you say, it's only $1,000 for it. And it makes for a phenomenal system.
I think DJI is one of those companies that I'm always excited to see what they put out next. If you remember episode 6, we talked about drones,
mm-hmm.
the DJI Phantom, which is what we've been using, the Phantom 3, I think?
Yep, Phantom 3 4K.
Yeah, and now they have the Spark coming out soon,
which looks... that's ridiculous.
So cool. Drone. Yeah, it's a drone that's about the size of your iPhone.
It's like the old old Parrot brand,
but actually good.
But high quality. Yeah, like if you would want to use somewhere.
But anyway, we'll talk about DJI's awesome new drone coming hopefully soon in a follow up episode of drones.
Yep.
But yeah, I mean that sounds like a pretty good place to start.
Yep, and the other nice thing I want to mention with this is, compared to the Glide Cam or a Steadicam, the learning curve on a Ronin is minuscule.
Yeah.
I think if you basically give yourself about an hour of messing around with it, as long as you're not doing any really wacky, crazy builds of having to put a really weird specialty lens or stuff like that, you probably have an hour and you'll probably have it down pretty well.
Well, and I think the other thing I've liked about them too is that you can have a separate camera operator that has a remote that can move the camera too,
mm-hmm.
just in case if you are the holder of the Ronin and you're walking or running over a whole bunch of stuff, like that video with the guy on the skateboard following with the Movi, he wasn't controlling the camera at all. It was someone
The rollerblades. It
wasn't
a skateboard.
Oh, I thought it was a skateboard. Anyway, so yeah. I mean, I don't think he really controlled the camera at all. It was someone else.
Right, correct. However, I'm glad they're trying to more streamline that control method, because the RC remote control camera controls they're not great.
It's a bit funky, and it's also a difficult thing to do unless you have plenty of wireless monitoring set up.
Yeah.
You can't really just control it and just stand off to the side and guess. Yes. What your framing is, you have to then go through the extra steps of having a wireless transmitter, which is another thing we need to talk about in a future episode, is wireless transmitters, because that's another whole can of worms.
Absolutely. But got to move on. But just to recap super quick, the Glide Cam HD 2000 starting at $550, going all the way up to the Ronin at $1,000, somewhere in there. It's, a decently, decent range of Steadicam options. Coming up, set etiquette and what to do and what not to do. Quiet on set is one of the commands you would hear.
Yes, that was a wonderful, wonderful segue moment.
I'm all about those.
Just kind of ruined it by calling it out.
And it's not the only one. There's a lot of on-set commands and little rules and things that you pick up along the way that are good to know going in. We're going to be working on a film coming up here in June, the three of us. And we just got off of helping out with a short this last month.
Mm-hmm.
So I learned a few things. David, I feel like you might have learned. I feel like we all learned a few things.
No, yeah, I think I absolutely mm-hmm. did. And another thing that we should preface this conversation with is some of these things, many of these things, it's a good idea to do it on any production of any size.
Yes.
But definitely, if you're doing a small thing where there's like it's three of you on crew, like there's one camera op, one sound, and the director, some of these rules may get a little fudgy because you don't have that luxury.
They can
if you will.
Scale with your crew sometimes.
Right. Yep.
But a lot of it depends on the department you're in, how mm-hmm. many departments there are.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, there's a lot of great video resources from this on the Rocket Jump Film School.
Mm-hmm.
And I think was that it? Or was there another channel that as well?
There's another good one you can see that you have to dig a little harder, but Film Riot has put out some videos about different aspects. Like they had a great one that I've used a lot, which is what makes a good second AC or second assistant camera or second camera assistant.
Yeah.
You have to dig through a little more on theirs.
And that's handy, especially if you're not sure exactly what those roles are.
Absolutely.
I mean, you know, being in high school, I used to think, oh, I'm the director. I hold the camera. Mm-hmm. And then you learn, oh, no, the cinematographer, the director of photography, you know, holds the camera. You direct. But as you get more and more into bigger productions, there's even more, you know,
you subdivide more.
Even more subdivisions, mm-hmm. yes. And so you get, you know, camera operator, first AC, second AC. Oh, my God, what mm-hmm. the hell do these people do? And yep.
And you can definitely see that, though, as you do production. Like, one thing we saw, like, you know, when we were in college and high school, I'm sure for all of us, we did a bit of anything, like everything. Like when Ben and I were in college and we were doing shorts, usually I wrote a lot of them and then I directed them. And I was also camera operator and was also the editor.
Yeah.
And then as you get into higher productions, you get to start splitting that a bit more, mm-hmm. spread it out. We got to Dawn Under Heaven. You had the luxury of, for the most part, you were really focused on directing.
Yes.
You did a lot of like helping set up and moving things around when need be. Mm-hmm. But we tried to make you get to, or it was my goal to try and have you focus as much on directing as possible.
Absolutely, and I think that made a big difference.
Mm-hmm. And as you grow, that's a luxury that you will gain especially as you make more friends and more connections, and you're able to expand your production from a crew of three to say a crew of 17.
Yes, and with having a big crew, obviously it's a lot to manage. Ben, you've been working on assistant directing work,
mm-hmm.
which in large part is a lot of management and a lot of, you know, controlling what happens on set.
Yeah. Luckily, I had like a minor in some management coming out of college. And then I've done my own team management in my day job. And luckily that's kind of helped me transition and kind of find a spot for myself in productions. And it's interesting kind of finding the balance and getting to know people and kind of being friendly, but also like putting your foot down in like either talking to, making sure PAs and the production managers are doing what they're doing, and then being a facilitator of communication between all the other different departments.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of etiquette.
So you mentioned managing the PAs and the production coordinator or production manager.
Like David said, it kind of depends on how many people are around. Like if you have a production manager, they'll work more with the PAs. But if there isn't one, then you'll, as an AD, you'll work more. Or second AD, you'll work more with the PAs.
Yeah.
It kind of depends on how many different complexities there are and how many people there are on a set.
David, I think when you were ADing on Dawn, you were also ACing. And
yeah, there were many, as I said, many of us wore. It was my goal to have you have as few as possible.
I think you should have had a hat that kept like turning and changing like
many, many faces from
yeah.
He-Man.
Yeah. I think there was a part where you actually were wearing two hats.
I think
joke.
I did as a joke, yeah. So I was doing AD, so I was doing a lot of coordinating and like setting up the shooting schedule and call. Well, actually, I think Ben was doing the call sheets.
I was, yeah.
But I was setting up a lot of that stuff. But the other thing I was doing was assistant camera to the cinematographer, depending on who it was on a given day of our shoot.
Mm-hmm.
And so with that one, with the assistant camera, your charge is the camera, as I like to look at it. Like your first responsibility is to the camera itself. And you deal with that from a technical aspect, whereas the cinematographer, or if it's a large enough production, has a standalone camera operator, worries about actually holding the camera and putting it in the right framing for whatever the DP wants.
Mm-hmm.
The camera assistant makes sure that the settings are all correct and where they need to be. They hit record. And also one of the, not to toot the horn of the assistant camera, but I think one of the most important things is that they're the focus puller. They're in charge of making sure that things stay in focus or the right things stay in focus at the right time.
Right.
In a given shot.
Right. Mm-hmm. You first AC'd, I second AC'd on the short last month, and there was a day I got to first AC, which was a lot of fun. I enjoyed it quite a bit. And a big part of the set etiquette we're going to talk about today is sticking to your department. And for me, it reminds me of a union job where you have your clearly defined union duties, and that's what you do and nothing outside that. Granted, obviously, there's some gray area.
Yep.
But your default position on a bigger production should be this is your department. It's like you know, military regiments.
Yeah.
You have your hierarchy and your place in that hierarchy. So, for example, on camera, you are working on the camera. You're not helping with grip and electrical setups. You're not advising the talent on how they should do another take.
Right.
You're working, you're like lenses and.
And I think I don't know if it was for you. I know it was for me. I think the first job I did where I had that luxury, because it really, especially coming from where we did and probably where many independent filmmakers do, it is a luxury. It's like, you just get to sit back there and like, I'm just worrying about camera. I'm just worrying about cinematography. I don't have to think about the lights or the.
You can focus on your work.
Yep. And for me, the first one was The Division. So it's a shoot we did with Corridor Digital. And that's the first one where like I got brought on to be assistant camera, and I just looked at the camera all day. And that's all I was doing. Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh, art department needs to do something? Oh, look, art department's coming in to do their thing. It's phenomenal.
You
I just got
sit
to stand
back.
There.
You don't have to run around.
I just had to watch the battery and watch the cards.
Absolutely. We were kind of tag team ACs that day, and it was a freaking blast. But the other thing is that's very important, that's hard to learn and feels a little counterintuitive sometimes, is to not crowd the camera and or monitors.
Oh, yes.
Because
that's a good point.
Those are only for a select few, for the camera operator and or DP, the AC, the first AC for focus, and not in the director. And not a lot of others are allowed to look.
Yeah, and it also this thing that is it also depends on how many monitors there are and where they are.
Yeah,
you know, if there's just basically if we're on a smaller shoot and they may just have the ability to have one monitor on camera, that really is for the, you know, like the DP and the AC.
Yeah,
it's you know they need to check focus, check framing. The director can they usually like review it later, or you know their focus on let's get the performance right. I can trust the DP to do the framing right.
Right.
But if you're dealing with a larger production, which we've had the luxury of having things like this, where we have a video village, so that's the you know a setup where there's one, if not two or more monitors, set up for that's you know way separated from the actual action of what's being filmed, you know, sometimes 10 feet away, sometimes a lot farther, depending on what you're doing. And if for that video village one, because you know usually the DP and the assistant camera are over at the camera, that one really is for like, it's the director and it's basically the creative heads of department.
Yeah.
So you look at the, you know, the head of art department, the head of makeup, cinematographer, sometimes if he or she is over there, the director, you know, if you're a PA, you shouldn't be anywhere near that monitor.
Yeah.
You know, if you ever impede one of those key people from doing their job, that's a big red flag.
Exactly. Another thing that I had to not learn the hard way, but became very apparent to me after working on a set for a few days, I think it was on his playground, is, you know, what do you call it, striking, when you are turning on
a bright light? Yeah.
I feel like a similar word comes to mind when, you know, they're rolling and you're looking at in the eyes of the talent. Like, don't do that. Don't look at the eyes of the talent as they're acting as a scene.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I was going to, do you have any comments on that? Because I think, but between the, well, actually, I don't know much about you, but I know between you and me, Ben, you have been on camera's talent, like 100 times more often than I have.
Sure.
Ben.
Well, I think it's great to just try to stay out of the mind of the actor because they're just hyper focusing on what they're doing and any sort of thing to take them out of that. You get self conscious when you're on camera. There's no way around that.
Yeah.
So when you have everybody looking at you, it's more pressure.
I kind of think of it like you are there to do your job. They're there to do their job, and there's no reason for. What? Do we need to cut?
Oh, just confused about what that sound was.
Oh. So the way I see it is like you're there to do your job. They are there to do their job, and you know as you're setting focus or slating or whatever your job is, like they're not looking at you like, yeah, come on, you fuck up, like let's go. So for you to just like stare at them and like get in their head while they're trying to do their thing, I feel like mm-hmm. is very distracting and kind of detrimental to the team dynamic.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And a related thing to that in with, you know, stick to your department is if it's not yours to touch, don't touch
it. Yes, a lot like theater rules.
Yep, mm-hmm. exactly. Like one thing that I know is a huge thing, like when we did Dawn Under Heaven, we had it very clear because we had prop guns mm-hmm. on it. And the thing is like, you are given a prop gun at the top of the day that is yours to touch and it shouldn't be anyone else's. Mm-hmm. You know, like if, and especially on other productions when there are fake guns, like it's cool, like they're fun to like play with or whatever. You know, if you're not the actor that belongs to or is using it, and if you're not the prop master, you shouldn't be touching it.
Yeah.
Or if it's a large production, you have like an actual firearms master who deals with specifically the firearm
yeah.
weapons. Same thing like, you know, if I'm a cabinet department, I'm not going to go and putz with a light. Even though it may seem like the best thing to do to make the thing go faster, if I know someone was told to move that light and they haven't gotten to it, it may be a thing where it's like, oh, I can help out and mm-hmm. I can go and help speed things along.
It's hard to get from that mentality too, especially working as in smaller productions where you are wearing a lot of hats. Like you want to help out, you want to be helpful.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And I think there may be a little bit of an exception with the short we worked on last month when it comes time to break down and haul things away. Yeah. Then I think the help is appreciated
mm-hmm.
and can speed things up.
Yeah, and although even for that, you do have to be careful if you aren't on a large enough production. Like on the production we're going to be going on, we're going to have a crew of about 17 people.
Yeah.
You know, at the end of the day, I don't really, like if I'm asked to do something and I'm told explicitly what to do, then I'd probably do it. But I'm not going to go and grab a stand and put it away because I don't know where it should go. I don't know, like, right. Are we staying in the list location? Is there a spot that it's being wrangled? Is it going back onto the truck? Where does it go in the truck? You know, if you've never dealt with a grip truck before, right. It's just a big vehicle for grip and electrical stuff, you know, you don't know where it goes. So you don't want to put it in the wrong place and then either delay somebody later having to fix what you did wrong, or worse yet even, the next day someone's trying to find it and they can't find exactly. that particular thing anymore.
Those trucks are so full, it's like Tetris anyway.
Yeah. The film set needs to be a finely tuned, oiled machine.
Yep.
And yeah, anything that you do to either have the production wait on you during shooting or screw up the organization at the end of the day. It's all stuff you want to avoid.
Mm-hmm. The one sort of demi, it's not an exception to this kind of rule, but it's a gray area of it, is when safety is concerned.
Yeah.
If there's a safety concern, then it doesn't really matter who you are or whatever. If you see something that you think is dangerous and you have a legitimate concern that is dangerous, then that is worth speaking up to somebody about.
Yes.
Like one thing, when we were shooting this short, there was a large electrical box that was in the space we were using, and there was a warning sticker on it that said, warning, arc risk. Basically, the risk of if there's a build up there, there could be an arc of electricity that jumps from the box to a person. And you know, that's a standard warning sticker. It's on all sorts of products. But it's something, like, I saw that, I'm like, I got to make sure that people know. So I made sure to tell the producer and the director about that. I was like, hey, I saw that sticker. We should be mindful.
If I remember correctly, that. You ran to them.
Well, running yeah. But so. As I said, like, you know, if you see something dangerous, you don't want anyone to get hurt.
Right.
Contrary to what, you know, the joke always is, we have to get the shot. We have to get the shot. But that is always completely secondary to any injury. There was a very famous injury 2 years ago, I think. A PA was killed on a film set because of, I think there was some mess ups on a couple different people, both inside the production and outside the production. But basically, they were filming on a train track. They thought they had all the okays, but a train came through. It hit a bed set that they were set up on the train track, and the debris hit this woman, and she died. And you know, that's one thing, like. And as I said, there were a couple failures in there, so it's not, you can't put it down one person or one circumstance that caused it.
Yeah.
But as I said, that's why you never want to be, you never want to take safety in a joking manner.
Yeah.
You know, you always want to make sure safety of the crew and the people is paramount.
So it's kind of a science, kind of an art, something that you are better off studying for in advance, but also learning while you're there. Something you can kind of feel out on set. But yeah, set etiquette, very important. Hopefully that gave you a little bit of a help there. There's also, like we said, the resources of Film Riot and Rocket Jump's YouTube channels where they talk about that sort of thing.
Rocket Jump Film School. specifically, because that's separate from Rocket Jump.
Mm-hmm. Rocket Jump, two channels. Very good point. Finally, we're going to be talking about Voice from the Stone, the indie from Eric Cowell. Be right back. So one thing that we typically do in this podcast is we once a month see a film in theaters, and this film was in theaters.
Yes, it was.
And I went to a theater in Minneapolis and saw it. It was the last night of the run, the theatrical run of Voice from the Stone. A film was, I think it was produced by Eric as well, or someone he knows.
I don't think it was directed by Eric Howell and starring the lovely Emilia Clarke of Game of Thrones
herself. They filmed it in Italy in a beautiful old castle, which originally they didn't have permission for, but since the funding got delayed for a year and a half, they got to know the family who lived there, and over the course of time, they agreed to let them film there. And beautiful, like, shot very well, gorgeous looking movie. But we need to talk about our thoughts. Ben, when did you see it?
I saw it probably about 5 hours ago.
Perfect.
I was wondering.
So your thoughts are fresh. What did you think?
They are. As far as the plot goes, I kind of felt like it was a mixture between Shutter Island and Sound of Music, where you kind of have like this weird, darker undertone.
Things the hills are alive with the deep voices.
So part horror, part romance, a little bit like that?
I'm not sure core is the right word. I think suspense and thriller, maybe, because Shutter Island wasn't really horror either.
Yeah, you're right. So suspense, thriller, but it also had the like the family romance.
Psychological thriller.
Specifically having... not governess, but basically that kind of like nanny-ish role coming into a broken home and dealing with children, I guess. It was interesting. I liked it. It was shot cool. I liked it, but I think towards the end, there were some plot holes I wasn't sure about.
I want that on their official like trailer where they have all the quotes from reviewers. It was shot cool.
It was shot cool.
Yeah, David, what'd you think?
I think I liked it. I agree. It was shot well. And one thing that we've been talking a lot amongst ourselves lately is the idea of good cinematography and how so many blockbusters nowadays don't have good cinematography. They just have shots. You know, it's like, what does the shot need to be to get everything across? And there's no...
Or it just feels uninspired.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think this was shot well. I thought that the acting... I enjoyed it. I think everyone did a good job in it. And I especially call it to the... The little boy, I don't remember what his character's name was or the actor's name was, but...
Jacob.
That was a spoiler alert with that. He doesn't talk much.
At all.
He talks a little.
Yeah, we can go into spoilers.
He doesn't talk much in it, and
he doesn't talk until the very end of the movie.
Yeah, almost one of the last
He says four lines, or four words,
yep,
and that's it.
And so, you know, he has to get a lot across completely, you know, through body language and whatnot. So definitely kudos to him, because I think he did a good job at it.
And, I think I agree with you guys. Obviously, I think we can probably agree that the weakest part is probably in the script.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
There are some, like you said, Ben, plot holes, but also muddled moments. And I think some of that they were going for in their attempt to not adhere to the tropes of a specific genre, but rather blending multiple genres together. I think that in the Q&A after the film, Eric answered some audience questions, and he went into wanting it to be a little ambiguous at the end, whether or not she's possessed or actually happy with the family.
It's a transference of consciousness.
Yes. It seemed that way, in that there was a couple... In the plot holes that I felt that were there, it seemed like a lot of it was due to ambiguity to how everything resolves.
Yeah.
And I can see how Eric intended it to be kind of like... up to the viewers or the audience's perspective for them to choose. But I felt like it was almost a little too ambiguous. That there were too many options that it could have been.
Yeah.
So like at the end of Inception, it's either a dream or it's not. And either way, it doesn't matter. It's the story is resolved. Whereas I feel like it wasn't perfectly done here.
Yeah, because there's a few different ways this film could have ended and none of them are similar.
Yeah.
None of them have the same emotional resonance, I guess. Whereas like an Inception, like you said, like he's happy in the end. That's all that really matters.
Yeah.
But I guess that is true in this case? Because she's happy. whether or not she's herself or not.
Yeah. Or she believes that she's happy because she was kind of coerced into this new style of thinking, which also kind of like happened.
Yeah, it felt quickly. She went from very professional and not religious or like believing in supernatural things. And it started to ramp up. And then it seemed very quickly to go from that mentality to her being like, obsessive. Obsessed. Mm-hmm. Like, I want to be part of this family and the voice is real and they're going to send me away. And she's freaking her shit about that.
Yeah.
That seemed a little weird to me. I think that maybe I missed something there, but I did like just how horrifying it was for her to realize that the old lady was actually a ghost. And then her having the dream, I thought it was real, of her being barricated in the tomb.
Yeah.
Well, so what I thought was potentially interesting is that the whole thing
is potentially interesting.
On the review trailer, potentially interesting, Ben Robertson.
I wonder how much of it was actually a dream, because it's a couple of things that are kind of alluded to. Like if she was in this suspended space where she might actually be dead. Like she wakes up out of this towards the end of the movie with this, where the audience is given this idea that maybe she just came out of her sickness.
Yeah.
If she is the mother.
Yeah.
So up until this point, she's been having this dream as she's been dead. One of the earlier things that she says in the movie is that dead people don't talk. And the only person who's not talking to her is the boy. So, okay, is the boy actually dead in this kind of
way? I don't know if it goes that deep.
Oh, wow.
No. I just think it's a little interesting in that she has this point where she dies and then is woken up at the very end. There's too many things that are going on.
Yeah. It's a little too unclear with how to feel about it. Like, if the movie was that, okay, that old dude is putting her in the tomb and, like, that's actually happening, like, oops. Yeah, I think it can be effective if told that way, where it's like this was a ruse and they just needed another human host. I mean, it's not like original, but at least I felt like it was more effective if they would have gone that route.
One thing that I did like with it is throughout your every once in a while you're given these few peppered moments of like when the dad is talking about his wife and his wife's sickness, and there's a few little flashback moments of her dealing with her sickness, and then at the end of the film, when it's all sort of coming to a head, it's all, I believe, are the same shots.
She starts to feel ill, and they have a shot of her, like, stumbling up the stairs.
Right.
Which, you first saw that shot, you thought it was the mother who died, but then you see that as Emilia Clarke.
Yep, or a similar one when she's laying in bed, and she looks out the door, and she sees the dad, like pull his son out and put him down, and then he grabs his coat to go and, you know, get a doctor or whatever.
Yeah. I guess you guys probably saw the plot twist of the grandma, but I didn't at all.
Yeah, I saw it when she was helping put on the dress.
Oh, when she just kind of backed away and didn't.
Yeah, because whenever the father was in the part of that scene, the old woman was not there.
Sure, that makes sense. Part of me, maybe it's because I find old ladies very creepy. So that was an effective twist to me. Oh. Old ladies as ghosts. Oh, like, God, what is it? I think, have you guys seen Insidious?
I didn't. No. No, I didn't see that one. Okay. I think so.
Well, anyway, the main, like, evil spirit in that one is this old lady, and she's scary as fuck.
I think the character that confused me the most in this movie was the old man. He seemed so, like, I don't know.
Oh, yeah.
He seemed off.
I think that's why I would have, in some ways, preferred the straight-up horror angle, because then at least you understand his motivation and what he's all about. Like,
sure.
Mm-hmm. I'm just here to keep things on an even keel, you know?
Yeah.
Human sacrifice style.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like the little foreshadowing they had with the cats being buried alive in the walls.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I did like the world-building and backstory about that castle where the family was, their wealth was in the stone, and then they filled in the quarry, and now they're buried in the tomb with the stone, and they buried the cats to keep away the evil spirits, and so this kind of like deep foundation of that family and their history with the stone and the dead being inside of it.
Well, and she becomes the voice in the stone from the stone at the end, because she's in her little tomb, and when she's speaking, she's talking in, like, she's a part of the castle. That's kind of the way that I took it.
Amelia Clark in the end?
Amelia Clark in the end. Because she's entombed, and she has a couple points where she talks.
So your theory is that that actually did happen?
No, I thought it was a dream.
But that's not what you just said.
She becomes the voice. I don't know. There's...
So either she's in the tomb or she's not, and you're saying...
See, this is what I'm talking about.
Well, if she had an out-of-body experience, if you will.
That's what I'm kind of trying to say. Is that like,
it was a dream, though.
Was it a dream or was it an out-of-body experience?
Well, it's not out-of-body if she's still her own perspective. Out-of-body is you see yourself.
Out-of-body, or she could have a moment of, I don't know, like a fever-induced flashback to... Like, almost like, what if this is the wife, dead, like, the perspective from there. Like, I think that there could be another, like, experience that it doesn't have to be in the bed or a dream. I think there could be I think there is a third option.
Go ahead, Ben.
Oh, I was going to try to wrap up this little part.
Well, no, I just as far as the tomb goes, so she's in the tomb. She's paralyzed, but she's awake. And the stone, like the brick and mortar, is being slathered on, and the stone slides over, and she's stuck in the tomb. And then it's just the sound of her breathing, and then the camera pans over, or like cranes up a bit, and then reveals the dead wife.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes this like kind of wet sound as her eyes open, like, I can't make the sound. Yeah, please don't. Come on, David. Anyway. It was creepy, but she was done up very well with makeup and everything. I wanted her to be just like disgusting and rotting.
Mm.
So, and we just spent the past like 5-7 minutes just talking about like what we thought it could have been, and I don't know if that's a sign of a good, a good story, and that we're talking about.
Chris Nolan does that a lot.
Yeah, it does.
But I'm almost a little frustrated because I can't figure it out. Whereas like the Christopher Nolan stuff, like either in The Prestige or Inception, like those are I enjoy that because I think I understand it enough.
And even if you,
I don't think The Prestige has an ambiguous ending.
Oh, I think you have not been on the internet. Then trust me. There's a lot of harsh debate about that.
Okay, I'll have to look into that later.
But yeah, no, I see what you mean. Even if you can, even if you debate the end of Inception with your friends, you yourself have an ending you're satisfied with believing. Mm-hmm. Whereas with this one, you're just really not sure, and because the movie maybe didn't give you enough to invest in one way or the other. I don't know.
Yeah.
But yeah, I definitely don't think it's 28 on Rotten Tomatoes, which is currently sitting right now.
Yeah, I don't think so either.
I don't want to live in a world where Voice from the Stone is lower in Rotten Tomatoes than 2004's King Arthur, which is at 33%.
Yeah, no, this is a lot better than that.
Yeah.
At least you had some connection with the character arc and understood the characters.
I will say, we talked to Eric at the bar afterwards, and we kind of agreed. I thought Emilia Clarke did a great job in this film, and her performance was so much more dynamic than it's been in Game of Thrones. So I think it's probably my favorite performance of her.
I would agree.
Ben does not.
I would say I haven't seen enough of her work. Like, I want to see her in different things besides just Game of Thrones and this. I want
to go watch Me Before You.
Yeah, that rom-com.
Yep.
I don't know if it's just a rom-com. Just rom?
Yeah, it's pretty close to
just
that.
Just a drum-rom?
Yeah, it's a drum-rom, yeah.
But...
I do think she acted really well in this. I would not argue that
at
all.
And the costuming was great.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I didn't notice this, but at the bar, it was as we're walking out of the theater, so there's a sex scene in this film.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
And...
Yeah. And it's also
yeah. Well, no, that's another point I think where the film jumps a little. It goes from them, Emilia Clarke and the father having a kind of a professional relationship, and then he reminds her of his wife and wants to sculpt her.
Let me draw you like one of my French girls.
Exactly.
Well, with a baguette and a couple of onions.
Well, then there's a part like where it looks like maybe they're having sex, and then it finalizes that whole scene with her like kind of getting off by herself.
Yeah, I think it was her imagining them. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No, wait. Sex. We should ask though first. Ben, did you know and notice anything interesting?
That's what
about?
I was going to bring up.
Okay.
And we didn't notice it. Yeah. But as we're walking out, he mentioned this.
But Ben, did you notice anything with that sex scene?
So there,
anything looks seem out of place?
There's a third hand. that comes out. Yeah.
The look on your face.
What?
So I think it's the, I forget if it's her arms around him or his arms around her, but there's a third hand that comes around.
Whoa. Yeah, a woman then. Apparently a prostitute. I think he said it was.
A ghost.
Interesting.
So I like that aspect, so I just wanted to go further with it instead of ending on a happy note, you know? I don't know. That's just me, though. Because it seems to be set up that way. And part of the difficulty, and maybe credit to this film, is the ambiguity. It's nice for a film to give you something different, but sometimes it doesn't feel as effective.
Yeah, well, maybe we'll just have to wait for Voice from the Stone, too. The Search for More Stone.
Yeah,
the
Search
for More Stone.
So on iTunes, it's $12, and there are special features, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, no, that's... Yeah, I want to see people doing that more. Like, if I want to... Because I do want to take up purchasing things on iTunes pretty much now, but I need my special features. Yes. I need my fix, man. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I don't just want the film. I want to know how
they
made it.
I think they've been pretty good with special features. The problem is I think sometimes they're too short, with exceptions for, like, Interstellar has some good long ones.
Oh, wait. Who was the worst one? Star Trek. The first Star Trek movie was a nightmare. Yeah. Because they made the terrible choice of fragmenting it. Mm. If you bought it from Target, you had different special features than if you bought it from Walmart, in which you had different special features than if you bought it on iTunes, which was different special features than if you bought it on Amazon. Mm. It was a terrible idea, and I hate
that. That's no good. I just want, just give me all the goods, Lord of the Rings style.
Yeah.
Marathon it.
You know, we were talking about that the other day, because I've recently been rewatching the behind the scenes of Lord of the Rings. And
like you do once a year, right?
Yeah, it's about once a year. Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe a little more often than that. And I was watching that, and because that's some of the earliest behind the scenes style making of stuff that I remember. So that would have been back in 2001 would have been, 2001 would have been when this came out. And in years later, I've always been like, this is so stupid. The Inception trailer, featurette is only 12 minutes. Like, what's that? Like, I'm used to behind the scenes that are an hour long or whatever. And then more recently, I'm like, oh, yeah, because it's Lord of the Rings, and because they have so much stuff and work they did for it, it's an epic.
And not even just one commentary track, but like five or something.
Yeah, I know that's one thing that my wife and I are going to do this month, is one of our things. Because one thing I realized, I don't think I've watched all the commentary tracks.
Me either.
So we're gonna start from the beginning.
And I think I've only seen bits and pieces from each one of them, but they're good, you know, and they come from different perspectives.
Mm-hmm. Another thing I think is lacking, especially from, again, maybe not for every film, but for some of these larger ones, you usually have it with like some of the actors, and they're like, oh yeah, no, this was a really challenging scene for blah blah blah, or like, oh, this is a funny story, an anecdote about, you know, with me and another actor or something, and maybe the director with a few points, but there's this whole breadth of information that is lost. You know, we don't have a record of like an interesting tidbit from, you know, one of the executive producers who's like doing it on Lord of the Rings, he could talk about, oh yeah, like we actually modeled the One Ring after my wedding ring. Was one of the cores. Like, there's all these interesting stories or interesting thought process behind the creative decisions that were made.
Yeah.
That sometimes get lost when they just make a sort of, if you will, like a floofy commentary track.
Yeah, that's a good looking ring, by the way.
It is.
When I look back at like older iterations or older interpretations of what the ring is, I'm like, nope, that's not what it looks like. But anyway, big tangent. But I recommend seeing Voice from the Stone, even if it's doesn't have the greatest reviews. Again, only $12 on iTunes.
And can you rent it? Could you rent it on iTunes?
You could rent it for about the $3 or $4 that it is.
Just buy it. Yeah. Support some good indie filmmaking.
Yep.
I mean, it is. It's really good. And it's only an hour and a half long, so it's not going to take up too much of your time either. So even if you really don't like it.
That's a weird way to pitch a movie. Listen, it's super short. It's not going to bug you too much.
On the preview trailer. Yeah.
It won't take up too much of your time. Ben and his freaking tagline. So thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Indie Film Toolkit Podcast. We'll be back next time with more awesome stuff to talk about.
See after production.
The search for more stone.